Don Jr. gave him some quotes about how the Trump family learned to monetize MAGA. So it's really not just the crypto dinner. It's properties in Doha. It's the executive club. It's the plane. I think he's doubled his net worth to something like $5.4 billion. There's just no modern parallel. And really, there isn't. Though, I don't think the crypto dinner was that fun. It really looked like he came in and then left, and everyone was disappointed because he didn't stay in schmooze and they weren't served Big Macs.
Susie, welcome to the Golden Age.
Andrew Zucker, thank you so much for having me. I assume this is the official drink of your podcast.
Yes, we have a button that we hit and it comes right out. So I hit the button before. Great. For those who can't see, it's a Diet Coke. I want to begin with the viral moment from over the weekend of the Macrones.
Oh my God. What was
Brigitte
that?
Slapping the Prime Minister of France. She just totally shoved his face while they're getting off the plane. So I thought it was totally bizarre and I wanted to get your take.
I actually didn't think it was bizarre at all. I think anyone in public office is like minutes from murdering their political spouse. And I'm sure those things happen all the time. It was like when Melania swatted Trump's hand. I'm sure there's many, many other instances of world leaders pushing each other. I mean, he sort of played it off like, oh, we were joking around. It was a moment of closeness.
His office denied it. And then they ultimately had to explain it away. But I mean, there are definitely some odd dynamics in their relationship. I think he was 15, she was 39 when they met.
Yes, she was his drama teacher.
He was classmates with her daughter, I believe, maybe her son, but one of her children. Yeah, so some odd dynamics there.
I don't judge an age gap relationship. Like, they're French. So I assume that's just
anything
each
goes.
Other on a private jet is like part of the foreplay, I'm guessing. But yeah, I mean, it depends how deep you want to go. I don't know if it's this kind of podcast, Andrew, if you want to really talk about Brigitte Macron, maybe we should move on.
Let's move on to the other big story, from over the weekend, which is Jake Tapper's book. It's the book that everyone in DC is talking about. Yesterday he even told Piers Morgan, that the cover up, with Joe Biden, could be worse than Watergate. And so I wanted to get your take. A lot of Democrats are flipping out over the part of the title, the cover-up part of the title. And so what's your take? Is it fair framing or is it out of line?
I think it's completely fair framing. I think anyone with eyes sort of saw what was going on with Joe Biden. I mean, before
the cover-up is a very specific term, that there was active...
I haven't read the book yet, but I think that bears out in their reporting that, you know, they were lying about his acuity and possibly the fact that he had prostate cancer. But I mean, I think any American could have seen that, you know, when they said, Biden stumbling is a deep fake. Is that what they called it? It's just like, it's like Brigitte Macron hitting her husband. You see it happening. You just
but
roll the tape.
If everyone can see it, then is it a cover up?
I think it depends. I think it depends on, if there were medical diagnoses, if they actually lied about him having them. But I mean, this is the president of the United States. He's getting worked up more than any other human being on planet Earth. I don't believe that they didn't know about the prostate cancer and likely dementia, though I'm sure there's not like a blood test for that.
And, you know, I think it's been a pretty nice gift to Trump, given the news stories and headlines that have emerged over the past week, particularly with the crypto dinner. It's
crypto
totally distracted dinner. From that.
Yes. I mean, Gabe Kaminsky, who's a reporter with me here at the Free Press, just put out a very well-reported story. Don Jr. gave him some quotes about how the Trump family learned to monetize MAGA. So it's really not just the crypto dinner. It's properties in Doha. It's the executive club. It's the plane. I think he's doubled his net worth to something like $5.4 billion. And Gabe got someone on the phone who said there's just no modern parallel. And really, there isn't. Though, I don't think the crypto dinner was that fun. It really looked like he came in and then left and everyone was disappointed because he didn't stay in schmooze and they weren't served Big Macs.
Well, there was a special reception for the top 25 Trump coin owners. But yes, this was 220 people at his private club in Virginia. But he did do a special party or get together or exclusive gathering for the people who bought the most Trump coins.
Right. I mean, you could argue, like, is this so different than, you know, a mega donor dinner in the Hamptons. But of course, at those dinners, it doesn't go to personally enrich the politician.
Right. So do Republicans just not care anymore about corruption when it comes to their own people?
I think the obvious answer is no, because it's happening right in front. They're not even trying to be subtle.
I don't think there's any other take besides that this was openly buying off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like sort of corrupt on its face, but you know, Eli Lake had a great piece for us about the art of the bullshitter, and people know Trump's a bullshitter, but they kind of like it because we sort of like, you know, someone who exaggerates, someone who sort of gives off that they have more than they do, or they could give you something that they don't, and people can understand or at least recognize bullshitting as like kind of a great American tradition, but the American voter does not like lying. And there's a fine but important line between the two of those.
And I'm not sure it helps cryptocurrency and its overall perception, given that it was used in this case for corruption.
Right. I mean, I think if crypto is going to stand the test of time, this really won't matter. It's interesting. What was the president? Gabe wrote about it in his piece. Ulysses S. Grant his brother-in-law tried to convince the president not to sell the government's gold supply so that he might become enriched off of it. So, you know, the Trumps sort of selling MAGA crypto dinners with Trump coin. I mean, there's a long line of presidential corruption that this comes from, but I don't think it necessarily negates the value of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency.
And Trump had another big event last week, which was that the House passed the big, beautiful bill. It only passed because Congressman Connolly, unfortunately, died from throat cancer.
Yes.
So
third Dem in the House to die
in the past 3 months. Yeah. Eight since 2022, all Democrats. So what does it say about the party that all these members are dying?
That they've no one to replace them. I mean, I think, you know, nothing a boomer loves more than holding on to power. But I think if they felt, and I think this is what you saw with the Biden presidency, he's like, yeah, I'm too old, but who do you want to do it? No one wants to vote for Kamala. She's never won a national election. But I think the Democrats are just digging themselves into a deeper and deeper hole. We're doing another series at the Free Press called Ancient Wisdom about, you know, things like aging gracefully, when to get plastic surgery, how to be a widow, and when to, you know, sort of understand and recognize that it's time to hang it up. And I think a lot of Democrats, I can think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Dianne Feinstein, Joe Biden.
Right. So they've lost the SCOTUS. They've lost the presidency, the House, all from kind of this geriatric mindset of a party.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's hubris. I don't know if it's, you know, this idea of we know how to do it better and we did it the first time, so everyone can stand out of the way, but they're ruining their legacy. I mean, the individual politicians are each ruining their legacy by doing this. And increasingly, they're letting the Republicans sort of take the mantle as the young, muscular party, which was never the case before.
But I also think Republicans have undergone a realignment, right, in a way that Democrats haven't. And so there's been this, obviously, MAGA shift in the Republican Party, which has introduced a new wave of new voices, oftentimes younger than the old guard, the McConnells of the world. And it speaks to kind of Democrats haven't, they've realigned certainly a little bit, but not to the same extent that MAGA has totally shifted the Republican Party.
It's sad too, because Beto looked so good on that Vanity Fair cover. I really thought this is going to be
Beto's
year.
That didn't age well at all.
This is going to be Beto's year in those jeans, and he dropped some F-bombs. I think Democrats are just, yeah, I mean, who else is a young Democrat? I mean, I was a Senate page in 2012, which was like, it was, I think, one of the oldest one of the oldest group of senators. You had Daniel Inouye. I think he was about 100. You had Senator Rockefeller from Virginia. He was extremely old. And back then, like, Kirsten Gillibrand was like the new young hot thing. She was like, oh my God, she is like an 18-year-old. She's like a kid. Barbara Mikulski was in the Senate then, also extremely old. Al Franken had just left. He was thought of as sort of like the young future of the party. Cory Booker, I don't even think was a senator yet, but it just goes to show, I mean, the Democrats have been extremely old, probably for 15 years. That's kind of my perception of it.
And so when you're looking ahead to 2028, are there people that you think could make some waves and could stand out? People in this new guard?
People in the new guard. That's such
Wes Moore, Pete Buttigieg. Why no Pete?
He's too short.
Too short?
Yeah, I think he's too short. No, I think Pete is just like tarred by like the Biden cover up. He was part of the Biden White House. And I think the whole like, you know, he had he, him and his bio, and then he took it down. And it's sort of like you would almost respect it more if he actually believed it. But it just sort of showed that he kind of goes with the wind.
It's the same thing with Newsom. I think that's part of his issue, too.
Yeah, but at least I don't think the country is going to vote for the man who presided over the current state of California. Honestly, Rick Caruso.
He's first got to win the LA mayor's race.
I think he's the future of the Democratic Party is probably Rick Caruso and people more sort of like what you would think of, at least physically, as like an old school Republican, like a classic Republican, like a Ronald Reagan type.
And so I want to talk about a potential third party in 2028. And that would be RFK maybe running again, perhaps with Tulsi Gabbard. Do you think that's a possibility? Everyone's tossing around the usual names, but no one really seems to be talking about the MAHA movement outlasting
the MAGA
and being its own party.
I don't know. I don't pay attention to politics that much, but like Kennedy,
his support
Yang
seems to keep growing. And also, by the way, his support within this kind of new media ecosystem seems to be as strong as any politician.
I think like a lot of people laughed off Tulsi Gabbard, RFK, of course, Marianne Williamson in the 2020 election. And I think they did that to their own peril. So definitely those people have more of a platform, have many more followers, can command more attention. Can that translate to, you know, a national campaign? I kind of doubt it. But I think MAHA's kind of doing pretty well in the MAGA tent. I mean, they're kind of RFK just today eliminated the COVID vaccine schedule for healthy adults and healthy children, I believe. So I don't think they're going to see a reason to try and break off and do their own thing that's doomed to fail when they have more power and purchase than they ever have or could have probably dreamed of.
Maybe he could extract concessions from the Democrats, just as he did with the Republicans, if he ran again and then was a free agent and
switch sides.
Yeah.
That'd be really interesting. I don't know. I mean, the thing is with RFK, he's his own worst enemy. I was listening to the Matt Friend interview. I won't try and do the Cheryl. But
thank you.
I won't do it. But it's like, you're like, oh yeah, it's like you're 80%. I'm like kind of behind you. And then he's like, the Ashkenazi Jews aren't affected by the COVID back. And you're like, oh my God, how did we get here? He's also old. How old is he?
I think he's almost 70, if not 70. And I think he's said publicly that he's not in the best health. Obviously, he had the
brain worm. Maybe a hawk. Maybe a hawk and Andrew Yang will maybe be on the independent party ticket in 2028. And Dean Phillips,
who ran in 2024. So I think that there seems to be
read his piece at the Free Press.
You can't plug your own projects on here.
Yeah, of course. Honey, what do you think we're doing here?
Well, I see the Free Press logo right behind you. A lot of Democrats, Democratic donors are trying to come up with their own Free Press and trying to come up with their own Joe Rogan style ecosystem.
That was such a smooth transition. I love that.
Thank you. It feels a little bit forced. Do you think that you can manufacture something like that?
No. And people act as if like Joe Rogan was like sent from a station.
He was a Bernie bro.
First of all, yeah, he was a Bernie bro. He loved Bernie. And he didn't come out of nowhere. He's been a huge entertainer for like 20 years, from MMA to Fear Factor. So you're not just going to take a random person and dub them. I mean, how many I open acts, all I see is is this the new left-wing Joe Rogan? Hassan Piker. I just saw that GQ did a huge spread with Adam Friedlander, who has the Adam Friedlander show, and he was a big part of Cumtown. You had the Pod Save America guys, who I think finally we can put them to bed. But, I mean, I don't think it's a matter of making a new Joe Rogan. I think it's a matter of winning Joe Rogan back, and I actually don't think that would be that difficult.
Right, and it seems to me like the people who take off in right-wing media circles and left-wing media circles are both anti-establishment. And so if you have the establishment funding the new voices, I feel like it's a recipe for disaster.
Also, when you have someone like David Hogg being like, we made men feel so bad. It's like, you mean what you did? Like, he was just first in line for all of the cancellations, all of this, you know, kind of progressive political project of the past 10 years. And now he's going on Bill Maher saying, you know, men really need to be able to focus on, you know, getting laid and having fun. I don't know why we made them feel so guilty. And it's like, you were presiding over it. Mm-hmm. Not just him, obviously. I don't want to call out David Hogg, but there's just this, yeah, there's this interesting amnesia that's happening, I think, among people who kind of were first in line with their torches 5 years ago, now saying, you know, Democrats, you know, you can't just lambast someone for the worst mistake they ever made. Kind of these lines that were part of, I guess you could say, the intellectual dark web or the heterodox world 5 years ago are now
just
so
be authentic
and obvious.
Just be authentic.
Yeah, I think with new media, too, it's, you know, it's funny. I don't think of Joe Rogan as, obviously, he's new media, but he's like,
but he's
so
been around as long as the medium. Correct.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking more at.
Though he has shifted his politics in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
Which is worth studying.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm kind of an everyman. I'm not an expert. I mean, that was obviously a whole debate with the Douglas Murray stuff. But, you know, there's something disingenuous there because obviously has a huge amount of power, whether he's an expert or not. So I think the next phase of media will have to be people like Rogan and everyone else who's part of new media owning up to the fact, okay, well, we got to figure out some way to fact check or understand what it is that we're putting out because a lot of people are listening to us and taking us at face value.
I also think that no one's going to know what the 2028 election is going to be like with AI and just the speed at which technology is changing. You were one of the first writers to write about how AI is impacting students in school. And so now we're seeing pieces in New York Magazine and the Wall Street Journal talking about the impact on teachers and how students are transitioning more to in-class essays. So where do you think this goes?
The return
of the Blue
Book
is back.
Ben Cohen wrote about that.
Is it
going to
be like calculators, meaning AI? Is it just going to be something that every student ends up using?
I think the future of education will be so wildly different than what we currently have that the changes will go much further than, okay, you can't have a laptop in class anymore. I have friends who recently had kids and they're like, oh, we have to save up for the baby for college. And it's like, you really think your baby's going to go to college? Like you think in 20 years you're going to be sending your kid to college? I don't think so. I'm a few years older than you, but you know, I think when I was in college, there was already this sense of like, does this totally make sense? It's like, what exactly am I here for? I think was like kind of a live conversation, especially all of the richest people were college dropouts and the most impressive
right.
people, the people you wanted to be.
But don't you worry that we're basically raising a generation of illiterate children our very eyes?
I don't think literacy and the current, like, I think being literate and thinking for yourself are not don't necessarily, you don't learn those things. I didn't learn that at the University of Michigan. I'll speak for myself.
And what do you say to teachers who feel defeated because of AI? High school teachers, not college professors, but high school teachers and middle school teachers who are now grading essays that all look the same and all read the same and clearly are just being plugged into a prompt and then being spit out.
Don't like assign homework like that. You know what I mean? Like find a way to make, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a teacher, but like ChatGPT proof essays, it must prompts, you know, discussions
probably in
class.
In class essays, yeah, probably would be the way
I think.
Forward.
But basically, I don't have like strong opinions on how education should change, but the AI is coming. It cannot be stopped. You cannot, you know, it's like the internet. So we're going to have to learn to live with it, because just saying to your students, you know, it used to be a big thing in eighth grade, you're not going to get your calculators in the real world. You're not going to be able to use it. Of course you are. You're going to get a calculator, like if a calculator did ecstasy, you know what I mean? So you don't worry about it. So yeah, maybe you'll see like a return to sort of like the Socratic method and learning the classics and the Western canon. I'm not sure how it's going to look.
The other big story in education, of course, is Trump v. Harvard. I think today that he threatened to strip $3 billion worth of funding. And
I thought it was $100 million, it is.
$3 billion in federal grants, $100 million today from other parts of his government, and reroute it to trade schools. And so some people are calling it a First Amendment violation. Others think it's long overdue. You've had people argue on both sides of this issue in the Free Press. I'm wondering where you stand.
Yeah, I read Tyler Cowen's piece, who's a Free Press columnist, who wrote very persuasively, I think, about, you know, yes, Harvard has sort of gone way to the left, gone off the reservation, however you want to say it. The question is, what do we do about it? Is it, you know, these arguably unconstitutional or illegal retaliatory attacks on Harvard and pulling their federal funding? Or is it, and this is always on the side I come down on, build new things. Forget the old world. Like, as far as I'm concerned, like, Harvard can choke. Like, I don't know. Like, that's not my alma mater. I don't really stay up at night worrying about, like, the state of Harvard and, you know, if it's going to get an extra $100 million of funding this year. I just don't. But I don't think what Trump is doing is probably legal, though I then read Solveig Gold, who wrote about, like, what is the point of universities? And she went to Princeton, and she writes about how the unofficial motto coined by Woodrow Wilson was the university in service of the nation. And then that became the university of service of the nation and all nations. And then it became the university of in service of all humanity. So there has been sort of this, like, bloating and, you know, unwieldy, like, it's become unwieldy what the mission of the university is and who it's serving and who it's for. And I think those are all fair questions to ask. The Trump administration does not have a light touch. But
they're bringing a hammer to this issue. But also, I mean, don't you think a little bit that it's first it's Harvard and I said nothing, and then they're going to come for every other institution?
Well, like, how do you mean? Like, I think Harvard does.
I don't think that this is going to be Trump versus Harvard. I think this is going to be Trump versus many, many, many universities.
Well, if he was imposing the same restrictions that he was on Harvard to all universities, then it would be less. I think he's retaliating specifically against Harvard because they wouldn't cede to his demands.
Which probably is unconstitutional.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. But I think the university and higher education has been rotted and rotting for a long time. So although I don't agree with the manner in which Trump is doing this, I think, you know, a shake up was due.
And what are the other pieces?
I know you're an institutionalist. Like, I know you are at heart.
Well, we can talk offline about this issue.
I mean, you know, I'm of a few minds, but I would encourage listeners to go read Tyler Cowen's piece about what to do about Harvard. And he talks a lot about, you know, what comes after Harvard? What does AI have to do with what comes next for Harvard? Of course, you have, you know, Harvard is one of the leaders in sciences and biosciences. And you hear about these, you know, 80, 90-year-old studies that are being axed. And of course, you know, those things are horrible. But I think we're in a pregnant moment in terms of education and what comes next. And I don't think it's going to look anything like what you or I experienced.
We're in quite the moment. And I'm wondering, what are the next, you know, few pieces that you're excited about that are coming out in the Free Press?
Oh, well, I have a weekly culture column now, which I'm very excited about.
You took on Anthony Bourdain fans this weekend.
I did take on Anthony Bourdain fans. I got a lot of text messages, and I've like written about pretty controversial subjects. As you know, I've never gotten more texts like, how dare you? Like, you went too far.
Yeah. What were you thinking?
I was thinking it's annoying that like that like the legacy of Anthony Bourdain is that you can sort of that all you should do is like kind of seek out the most like thrill seeking novelty behavior around food. I mean, I think food culture is broken in many ways. I think part of the reason it's broken is because of, you know, everyone kind of chasing the high, the bar that Anthony Bourdain set. But yeah,
so you're more a Tucci.
I love
person.
Stanley Tucci. I think he's great. I think he's a good role model. I think he's a good eater. He's a good, what's the word I'm looking for?
What's mixologist?
No, not a mixologist. of course I'm going to think of it. Like a gourmand, but not like a hedonist, but like an eater and drinker, whatever. I'm going to think of it later and then we'll tell the listeners. But
we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
Any other pieces that are coming out that you're excited about?
I just did a big piece on Ozempic that I'm really proud of. Your mother reached out to me. She really liked it.
Great.
I was happy about that. I think I'm probably gonna do something on like the wellness to Jesus pipeline. A lot of wellness influencers are becoming more religious.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. I'm always on the lookout. I saw the movie Friendship last night, and I'm going to write about that. I'm going to write about And Just Like That, the TV show. Hoping to do a few profiles, have some ideas in the barrel. What about you? What are you working on?
I would like to write about how people are designing their podcast studios, because I think your studio looks really good behind you, and I think it would make a good piece.
Remember during COVID where it was like the status bookcase?
That was on cable news, but now it's all about podcasting.
What was the Robert Caro book? The Power Broker.
Power Broker.
Everyone had The Power Broker. That was like really your signal. It's funny now when people have like 8 copies of their own book, like strategically placed. I don't know. We have an Emily Oster here. Nellie Bowles. I wonder how that got there. We have a lot of great books.
All right. Well, Susie, I'm sure in the next few years, your book will be up on there. I have big expectations for you. Thank you for coming on The Golden Age. And I look forward to having you on again soon.
Do you want to talk about Jordan Hudson?
Why don't we save that for the next time?
Okay, let's save it for the next time. Thanks so
much. See you,
Susie. Andrew. Bye.
Bye.